ask. Actually, multiple questions, but this is another question we ask. What did Adam experience that Eve did not experience? Well, it was a difference in the way they were created. Adam was created outside the Garden of Eden. Eve was created inside the Garden of Eden. If you want to know why God held Adam to a higher account than Eve, it's because he had the experience of seeing what life was like outside the Garden of Eden. And when God pronounced a curse on him, he basically said, you were living in this wonderful garden that I planted for you, where everything was provided for you. You're now going to have to make it on your own in the real world outside the Garden of Eden. And Adam already knew what that world was like. So no thorns and thistles inside the Garden of Eden, plenty of thorns and thistles outside the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden was a well-tended garden. Outside it was a wild realm that needed to be tended. So Adam and Eve were now put into that position. Okay, and a question we did not address is why did God eject Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden? Here they're in the Garden of Eden. They rebelled against God. And, you know, when we parents have one of our children doing something that we realize is immoral, we don't kick them out of the house. We leave them in the house and we try to restore them. God didn't do that. He literally kicked them out of the Garden of Eden after they rebelled against him. And there's been a lot of debate about this over the centuries. It goes all the way back to the early church fathers. And this also may be a lesson for those of us that are parents. Make sure that when you're disciplining your children, don't make life too easy for them. And we actually see this in the curse that God pronounces upon Adam and Eve. He says, from now on, because of your rebellion against me, you're going to experience more pain. You're going to experience more work. And if I leave you in the garden, that's not going to happen. So he kicked them out of the garden so they'd have the opportunity to be blessed by the extra work and the extra pain. And I've always had a fun time trying to explain this to my sons when they're growing up, that the fact that I was disciplining them by imposing extra pain in their life and extra work, I mean, the thing they really hated was me telling them they had to clean up their room. Cleaning up the room meant they were going to be experiencing a lot more work, a lot more pain. They really wanted to get back to the things they really enjoyed. And so it's important that life not be too easy. And so in the Garden of Eden, everything was taken care of, and therefore God took them out of the Garden of Eden. And then what would have happened to Adam and Eve if they ate of the tree of life? And hey, this is kind of a class. I kind of like to look at it as a Sunday class. And so we have a microphone back there. I want some of you to go back there and tell me, what would have happened to Adam and Eve if they ate of the tree of life? Because the next thing we notice is God takes away access to the tree of life. So eating the tree of life would have brought some benefits, but also would have brought some consequences. Tell me what the benefits would be. Tell me what the consequences are. And again, I kind of think of what it's like when we parents are raising our children and we're trying to change the way their behavior is acting. And we basically tell them, this is for your own good. And now all of you have been parents. You ever said that to your child? This is for your own good. Did they believe you? Chances are they didn't. And so it took a bit of explanation to them for them to realize, okay, this is actually for your good. And so what would have happened to Adam and Eve if they ate from the tree of life? Okay, got a lot of people here. Someone's got to come to the microphone and give the answer. So, I mean, after all, this class does have people participating with us online, live, and so they're part of the class too. And if someone online wants to make a point, we'll let them speak. But why don't we get somebody here to stand up and go to the microphone so that, all right, thank you. Always can count on Steve. Go for it, Steve. Yeah, can we get some?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Thank you.
My understanding, maybe the idea is that it provided some, maybe some sort of a nutrient that kept them alive, you know, indefinitely. So if they had eaten of that, they would have lived in their sin indefinitely. So that's definitely a problem.
Very good. So Steve is making the point that if they had actually eaten of the tree of life after they had sinned, they would be able to continue living physically for the rest of eternity. But the problem with that is they would have been living physically eternally, but eternally being spiritually dead. And so, again, when we're trying to explain to our children, look, we're taking this away from you, but here's the reason why. And so God is basically explaining to Adam and Eve, and through them, all of us, it's better that we physically die and actually have an opportunity to be delivered from spiritual death than to be physically alive forever, but also eternally, spiritually dead forever. So God's goal is he'd be able to treat us differently than he treated the angels that rebelled against him. As we learn later in the Bible, one-third of the angelic hosts sided with Satan and rebelled against God. What we notice as we read through the entire Bible about what it says about these fallen angels, these sinful angels, there is no pathway for redemption. The problem is they are eternally, spiritually dead. And God's point was, okay, I made these human beings with a capacity to be mortal. And that means that there's a different way he can treat us than the angels. So his goal is to use physical death as a tool to deliver us from the far worse consequence of spiritual death. And hey, you only have to physically die once. Although maybe Moses gets to die twice, who knows? He shows up again, it looks like, in the book of Revelation. But the vast majority of us, we only have to die physically once, but then we get to enjoy, if we have that relationship with Jesus Christ, to spend the rest of eternity spiritually alive. And moreover, we have the promise later on in the New Testament that, hey, we will regain a physical body, but this will be a physical body that doesn't need access to the tree of life. God's going to give us an incorruptible body because he's going to put us in a realm where there won't be any entropy, there won't be any decay, there won't be any death, and our bodies will be able to live physically forever, and our spirits will be physically alive forever. And so this explains why God said we must prevent Adam and Eve and their descendants from getting access to the tree of life. And you see this in Genesis 3, 22 to 24. Well, what does God do? He sends two high righteous angels, cherubim, with flaming swords to block access to the tree of life. Adam and Eve may have wanted to gain access to the tree of life, but that access was blocked by these two angels with these fiery swords. And then later, God simply took away the tree of life from our planet, so none of us could have access to the tree of life. And this is really for our own good, that, hey, we get to die physically. And moreover, what we see in Genesis chapter 6, God says, it's not good that you live for hundreds of years on planet Earth. I'm going to make sure you only live for decades here on planet Earth. Is there a problem here?
Yeah, we're having some issues, so you're not seeing your...
Not seeing my slides?
It's not sending her
somehow. Okay, how about now? Is that working? Let me try this. Now it's good? How about now? It's good. Okay, fantastic. All right. So, moving on from what would have happened. What was the curse? We see this in Genesis 3:17. God pronounces a curse upon Adam, upon Eve, upon Satan, and upon the ground. So four curses. And the curse he pronounces upon Adam is that from now on, he's going to have to work harder. life isn't going to be easy like it was in the Garden of Eden. He's going to be working harder. Now notice this isn't work for the first time. When God created Adam, he put him in the garden and told him, I put you in the garden, you're to work the garden and tend it. So there was work before the curse. Are we still having problems? Notes page, okay. Yes, let me do that. That should fix it. Okay, thank you. All right. Okay. Isn't it wonderful to be living in an age of technology? Man, I'm always amazed how Jesus could speak to thousands of people without a microphone, without any kind of a projector or computer. So these days, if you don't have a computer, you're really out of luck. Don't have a microphone, you're out of luck. Kind of reminds me of the first time I went to the Soviet Union to speak. I said, okay. This was before they had computers everybody had. I said, where's the overhead projector? They said, we don't have overhead projectors here. And I said, well, I see you've got some blackboards. They said, our blackboards don't work. I says, what do you mean your blackboards don't work? I said, try it for yourself. They gave me a piece of chalk. I went to the blackboard, and you're right, yeah, it didn't work. The chalk didn't work, the blackboard didn't work. Fortunately, they had a microphone. So the basic thing is, great that you brought all these visuals with you, but all you got is a microphone. So when I went back in 1994, I actually could use visuals, but not during the Soviet era. Okay, for Adam, the curse was you're going to have to work harder than you worked before. Then he speaks to Eve and says, from now on, you're going to experience more pain and more pain in childbirth. Now, this has led to a lot of debate because women have made the point, wait a minute, it's not just my husband who has to work harder. I have to work harder too. And the husband says, you're not the only one that's experiencing more pain. I experience more pain too. And it says more pain in childbirth. How does the husband participate in more pain in childbirth? Well, my wife is 5 foot 4.5 inches, and both of us are kind of the short people in the family. I come from a family where everybody is 6 feet tall except for me. Some of my relatives are 6'7.5". In Kathy's case, she's got a brother who's 6'1", and her mother is tall. And so we told the obstetrician when Kathy was pregnant, my wife might have a large baby. He looked at the two of us and said, there's no way. Don't worry about it. Well, when our firstborn came from Kathy, he weighed 9 pounds, 2 ounces. He was skinny, 23.5 inches long. He was just skin and bones, but he weighed 9 pounds, 2 ounces. And my wife really suffered through that pregnancy. A little easier with her second one, but our second one was 9 pounds, 5 ounces. Both of our sons are 6'3". But I remember as our sons were growing up, my wife would say to me, I went through a lot of pain in the childbirth of our two sons, but it's nothing compared to the pain of watching our sons grow up and seeing them make mistakes, seeing them go their own sinful ways, warning them that, hey, this is not good for you, and they go ahead and do it anyway. And he says, that's the real pain in childbirth. And it's the pain that fathers experience just as much as mothers experience. And likewise, it's not just the men that have to do more work because of their sin. Women are also involved in that more work. In fact, we also notice in the book of Ecclesiastes, it makes the point that the more we sin, not only do we experience more pain, we experience more work, we also see that our valuable time gets frittered away. I mean, going back to the analogy where I would discipline my sons and say, look, I want you to clean up your room, not just to the standard I want, but to the standard your mother wants. And they would really groan, because Kathy had quite a high standard. But what they experience in cleaning up the room, number one, they experience more pain, they experience more work, and a lot of the time that they wanted to spend on other activities was simply taken away from them. But these three curses are actually powerful tools in God's hand to restrain the expression of human sin and evil. And it's true. Of all of us, the more we sin, the more pain comes into our life, the more work we have to do, the more time we waste to undo the damage of the sin and evil. But something you parents in the audience have probably observed as your children were growing up is how skillful your children are at transferring the pain, the work, and the waste of time to their parents or to their brother or to their sister or to someone else. And that's why the big challenge of being a parent is to ensure that the one that perpetrated the sin is the one that experiences more pain, more work, and wasted time. We actually see that built into the prison system of the United States. Probably doesn't operate as well as it did today, as it did 200 years ago, but the whole point is that when someone is put into prison for a crime, while they're in prison, they experience more pain, more work, and more wasted time. And again, we have a tiered system. Those criminals who have committed more grievous crimes wind up being put in a special prison where there's even more pain, more work, and wasted time. And it's all based on the fact that God designed us biologically that we don't enjoy needless extra work, needless extra time, or needless extra pain. And so the laws of physics actually motivate us to avoid evil and pursue virtue. I remember explaining that to my sons when they were growing up, how God designed thermodynamics, electromagnetism, gravity, and the strong and weak nuclear forces to guarantee that the more sin we commit, the more pain we experience, the more work we do, and the more time that they waste. When they got into their early 20s, they told us that the most painful thing about the discipline I brought into their life were my lectures on the laws of physics. So, but notice what we see in Scripture. Those laws of physics remain in place as long as there's sin and evil. The moment that God eradicates sin and evil, we enter a realm where there is no thermodynamics, no electromagnetism, no gravity, no strong, weak nuclear force. They're no longer necessary because sin and evil are no longer an issue. But they were an issue when Adam and Eve sinned, and so he pronounced that upon them. And he also put a curse upon Satan, and basically saying, there's going to be enmity between you and the woman and her offspring from now until I wind up eradicating evil and suffering once and for all. And basically said to Satan, you'll strike the heel of Eve's offspring, but her offspring will crush your head. And so we see right here in Genesis 3, a prophecy of the coming ministry of the second person of the triune God, how the Son of God will come to earth with a mission to open up the pathway where we can be delivered from sin and evil. But Satan's going to attack the Son of God during the incarnation, will strike his heel, a reference to the fact that he's going to be unjustly crucified and die on the cross, but also says that that death on the cross is going to wind up crushing the head of Satan himself. So the heel of Jesus gets bruised, but the head of Satan gets crushed, all the way back in Genesis chapter 3. And then in Genesis 3:17, it says, cursed is the ground because of you. And there's a major debate within the Christian community. Did the laws of physics change when Adam and Eve sinned, or did it not change? Well, what you notice is that you have the sun shining before Adam and Eve sin. The sun shines after Adam and Eve sin. They're eating before they sin. They're eating after they sin. Those processes are extremely sensitive to even the tiniest changes in the laws of physics. For example, if you were to change the laws of physics by as little as one part in 10,000 trillion, you wouldn't have the sun and stars shining in a manner that would make possible the existence of life within our universe. So the laws of physics didn't change. It's the same laws today as it was before. What did change were human beings. Human beings were no longer in a sin-free state. And because of that, the ground would no longer produce like God intended before. So God was saying, hey, we were in the Garden of Eden, you were without sin, and notice how plentifully the Garden of Eden provided for your needs. Because of your rebellion, now when you work the ground, it's not going to produce for you like it did before. And what we notice is when human beings are working the ground today, because of their pervasive sin, they wind up despoiling the ground on which they depend for food. So cursed is the ground because of you. It wasn't cursed because God changed the physics of the ground. It was cursed because now we got sinful human beings working it. And even under the best of conditions, we notice that the agricultural land is abused by the humans that work it. So for example, we notice even here in the United States, where there's a high premium on maintaining high quality agricultural land, our lands are getting saltier and saltier as we continue to work them because of the way we irrigate our lands, and so they're not as productive as they were 200 years ago when humans first began to do large-scale agriculture in North America. Cursed is the ground because of you. And hey, again, as we sin, we realize, wait a minute, maybe we need to manage the ground a little better than we have before. And yes, the less we sin, the more productive the ground is, the more we sin. And I remember when I spoke in the Soviet Union, there were people there who had PhDs in agronomy that were making the point. Yeah, because of the way Lenin and Stalin ruled the Soviet Union, even though Russia was a very agriculturally productive place, they simply were not growing the food they needed to deal with the famines that broke out because of the fact the agricultural land was not being managed the way it should have been. It's like we should have been able to produce three times the food that we needed, and we couldn't do that. Jesus told his disciples in John 16:33, in this world you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. In this world, you're going to have gravity and thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and because of that, you're going to have tribulation. And probably those of you a little older have already noticed that. Hey, when you get into your 60s and your 70s, suddenly it takes a little more energy to be able to walk 10 miles to visit one of your relatives. Or you notice that you've got back issues, that things don't work as well as they did. And you can't run as fast as you did. And, you know, I run every day, but I notice the speed at which I run is only half of what it was when I was 50 years of age. And when I was 50, it was nothing like it was when I was in my 20s. And so we all notice we live in a world, even if you live your life in the best possible way, you'll discover tribulation is inevitable. It takes work to walk. It takes work to run. In this world, you have tribulation. But Jesus also made the promise that there will come a time when there won't be any tribulation. Right now, we need the tribulation. Without the tribulation, evil would run completely out of control. And as I mentioned in Genesis chapter 6, God basically told the human species, with the flood now being over, your lifespan is going to be shortened to a maximum of 120 years. He's basically telling us, because of your sinful state, it's really not to your advantage to live for 500, 600, 900, 969 years in the case of Methuselah. What happens when you allow human beings to live a long time in a sinful state? Those that are especially sinful don't have just decades to wreak evil upon their fellow human beings, they have centuries. And if you give a serial killer centuries to live, how many people do you think they're going to kill? And do you think they're going to be killing other serial killers? No. they're going to be killing off the righteous. There's a reason why when people were living hundreds of years, had the potential to live hundreds of years, only one righteous family was left. It's because those who are evil, living hundreds of years, basically were killing off the righteous humans in the population. And so Jesus says, I'm going to bless you with a short lifespan. You know, a lot of us really enjoy having a long life, but God is really telling us it's better that you don't live a long time. And so, and by the way, that 120 years has proved to be a hard limit. There have been individuals that claim to live longer than 120 years, but they didn't have the paperwork to prove that they did. Or they actually have a birth certificate and a death certificate. The longest anyone has ever made it is 117 years. So, and by the way, the Bible also tells us if you happen to make it to 110, your life is going to have a lot more tribulation than when you're 20 years of age. The older you get, the more tribulation you have. And I remember both my dad and my father-in-law telling me when I was in my 30s, getting old is not for wimps. It really takes someone with a lot of courage, a lot of fortitude to be able to live into their 80s, 90s, 100s, 110s. So, now, again, did the fall change any physics? I already made the point that, hey, you got the sun shining before Adam fell. The sun was shining after Adam fell. Changed the laws of physics, particularly the electromagnetic force constant, the gravitational force constant. Change any of them by 1 part in 10 to the 40th. You're not going to have that scenario in Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. Even the tiniest change is going to make a difference. Likewise, just the process of eating. Look at all that food there on that table back there, the treat table. Do you know just partaking of the food there is a testimony that the laws of physics haven't changed? When you eat food, even the tiniest changes in the laws of physics are going to upset your stomach. They're going to do more than that. You're not even going to be able to generate the energy you need from eating the food to do useful work. I mean, it really is a miracle that the food we eat enables us to do all the work that we do. I mean, just take a course in thermodynamics, and you'll be amazed at the utter miracle that eating food can actually help us be able to do the things we do. And it's especially true of us human beings. I mean, the special thing about humans, you want to know why we're unique amongst life, how we're in the image of God? Given our body weight, we need the most calories and the most nutrients of any other animal. I mean, we're just eating all the time. But the amazing thing about human beings, God gave us a brain and gave us limbs, legs and arms, whereby we could accumulate a huge amount of calories with way less effort than the rest of life on planet Earth. So we're kind of at the top of the heap. In fact, we get to have 4 times as many heartbeats as any other animal on the face of the earth during even our short lifespan. I mean, again, if you live to be 970, that's about 9 times as much time. But even now, the number of heartbeats we get to experience. So there are animals that live longer than us, turtles, for example. But I think what really counts, how much can you achieve within your life? You ever watch these giant turtles that live for hundreds of years? They really don't accomplish much in their life. They're just kind of slowly walking around, not really doing much. They're not putting men on the moon. They're not writing treatises. And they're not running marathons or Ironmans. They can't do that. We humans really are at the top of the heap there. But actually, the Bible explicitly declares that there's been no change in the laws of physics. Jeremiah 33, the laws that govern the heavens and the earth do not change. What you see in Jeremiah 33, God is contrasting his immutability. He's basically saying to the Jews, you change your mind all the time, but I'm a God that does not change. I'm the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And as I don't change, neither do the laws that govern the heavens and the earth change. This explains, for example, why the scientific revolution exploded at a Reformation Europe and how that revolution has been sustained to this day. It is true that people living under a different religious worldview, they had these sparks where science kind of bursts, but notice it quickly snuffed out. So for example, we see in Islam in the 9th century, they invented algebra, but we don't see any revolution exploding out of that. Likewise, we see in China under Confucianism, they invented gunpowder, but we really don't see it being exploited for mining industries or what we see here. It took the Reformation, where people began to read the Bible for themselves in the 1500s and 1600s to launch the scientific revolution. And what happened in the 1500s is that Christians reading their Bible notice the Bible declared there's no change in the way physics works. And that meant that they could trust their measurements. So in Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, there was no basis for trusting your scientific measurements. But the laws of physics don't change. That means I can trust my observations and measurements to reveal truth. The Bible is also unique in stating that God reveals himself through two means, scripture and nature, and how both are utterly trustworthy and reliable. So that was the birth of the scientific revolution. And then I would add that what we see in our observations of the natural realm, there can't be any change in the laws of physics, because if there were, we would see it in the spectra of stars and galaxies. And you may not know this, but every time we astronomers look at a spectrum from a star or a galaxy, we're measuring the laws of physics. So for example, we can take the spectrum of a quasar 10 billion light years away, and we can measure what the laws of physics were when the light left that quasar. And by the way, we can measure it to multiple places of the decimal. And so what it tells us is the laws of physics when light left that quasar 10 billion years ago is identical to the laws of physics we measure in the laboratory. There's been no change. We see that in every spectrum of a star, every spectrum of a galaxy. And as such, it tells us that we see in the spectra of stars and galaxies, the laws of physics are identical throughout the past 13.5 billion years. Now, I remember having a debate with Henry Morris II. He said, okay, I get this about the spectra of stars and galaxies. How about if I say that the universe is billions of years old, but the Earth is only thousands of years old, so he can support his view that the creation days in Genesis are 6 24-hour periods. And I said, well, we also have radioisotopes on the Earth. And said, notice that we don't have any Neptunian in the crust of the Earth. We don't have any plutonium in the crust of the Earth. And the reason why is those are radioisotopes with decay half-lives of a few million years, which tells us our planet must be at least 2 billion years old to explain why we can't find any Neptunian or any plutonium. And I remember him saying, well, how do we know there's plutonium and Neptunian on the face of the Earth? Because I said, here's how we know. Neptunium, plutonium decay into daughter products. And the daughter products that we see have a unique signature that tells us there was plutonium on the face of the Earth. And one isotope of plutonium has a half-life of 82 million years. So the fact that we see no plutonium, yet we see the decay products of plutonium 82 tells us that the Earth must be about 4.5 billion years old. So the radioisotope decay products that we see on the Earth tell us there's been no change in the laws of physics, not only in the universe, but that's also true of planet Earth. Okay, I see I'm past my time. So next week, we're going to finish up Genesis chapter 2, looking at what Genesis 2 says about the Trinity. We're also going to look at this question, probably one of the most hotly debated issues in the Christian community. Did the fall of Adam initiate death amongst animals and humans? What has the Bible got to say about this? So we'll cover that next week, and a lot more. There's a lot of doctrine in the book of Genesis chapter 3. One of my favorite passages, it actually establishes that all of humanity comes from one man and one woman. It's built right into Genesis chapter 3. You might want to go home and look it up and see where does it say that all of us come from one man and one woman. Because it's another big debate amongst Christians. Do we come from a population of human beings, or do we come from just one man and one woman that God specially created in the Adam and Eve? So we're going to try to tie a bow around that and then finish up by going into Genesis chapter 4. So with that, I'll take questions, and again, on any topic, and we'll alternate between people that are participating with us through live streaming and people that are here in person. So it looks like we got an online question.
We have a few, but let's see, anybody in the house have a question? Steve, come on up. And we'll go to online next.
Okay, we'll start with a question from someone here.
So earlier we were talking about the tree of life. And so I just wondered if you have speculated on what that might have been exactly. Was it an actual physical protein or elixir or fountain of youth that they could take and it would keep their bodies going, their cells regenerating? Or was it maybe a more spiritual, you know, thing? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, good question. Something we've debated a lot amongst the scholars at Reasons to Believe. What is it about the tree of life that would have reversed the effects of decay in the bodies of Adam and Eve and any human that partook of it? And so, well, as you age, your cells break down, cells die, and also what happens is that your chromosomes get shorter and shorter. Incidentally, that's the number one reason why you're not going to make it past 120 years. As you get older, your chromosomes get shorter and shorter and shorter. And eventually they get so short that you can't live anymore. And that's actually a good thing, because we now live in a radiation environment. That's not the case for people living before the flood. They lived in a much lesser radiation environment than we do today. But because of that radiation environment, it's crucial that our chromosomes get shorter and shorter as we get older and older. That acts as a powerful check against cancer. In fact, what's interesting is when you look at people that have lived past 115 years, every one of them has telomerase shortening that's much more than the case of the norm for the human species. So it seems kind of weird that the shortening of your chromosomes guarantees you're not going to make it much past 120, but it's interesting the people who live the longest or those that have their chromosomes getting shorter and shorter at a faster rate, basically making the point, hey, that's not the case. You're going to die at a much earlier age from cancer. So yes, Steve, kind of what I'm speculating, there's something about eating of the fruit of the tree, of the tree of life, that actually would restore the telomeres, but at the same time, take care of all the damage that was taking place in the cells, and may have had an effect on restoring the microbiome, because that's another reason. If you want to live a long time, take really good care of all those bacteria that are in your gut. That's going to actually help you think better and live better. So exactly, we know that much. If you want to reverse the effects of aging, you got to help the microbiome. You got to restore the lengths of the chromosomes, and you got to take care of all the cell damage that's taken place in the body. And you know, one of my sons is a clinical neuropsychologist, and he says, you know, I can see in my medical career, maybe we can actually deal with heart disease and get people living much longer than those 120 years. Maybe we can find a way to take care of cancer, especially with the way we're aggressively trying to detect cancer before it becomes a killer. But he says, the thing I notice is the brain seems to be the big limit. There's a limit to how long the brain can function at a healthy level. And you know, we kind of had a debate about this because I was pointing out to them, these people lived from 110 to 117. They're all mentally sharp during those years. So there's something about that. And the other thing that's interesting, All of them have a VDL. That's a really bad cholesterol that's in your bloodstream. That's at a level of about 1. And, you know, my doctor is really thrilled that mine's at 11. That's considered to be extremely low. But it's high enough that I know my brain won't be sharp at 115. Hopefully it's going to be sharp long enough that I'll be able to keep teaching this class for a while. So, those are my thoughts about what the Tree of Life might have been able to do. And there's also been a big debate. If that's the case, how frequently would Adam and Eve need to partake of the Tree of Life in order to live forever? Some people have suggested maybe they only need to eat from it once, based on what you see in Genesis 3, 22 to 24, where basically God said, we have to stop access to the Tree of Life lest they live forever. Theologians have cited that as saying you only had to eat of it once to reverse the effects of decay in your bodies and live forever. But other theologians argue you'd have to eat of it repeatedly. It's all based on exactly what does that fruit do.
Ready? Would you like a nice comment first?
A comment? Sure.
Okay. This is from Messianic Gentile. I love this class. It's such a blessing. If I lived in Sierra Madre area, I would be there live every Sunday with a box of donuts.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Here's a question from Omnipo. Dr. Ross, Michael Heiser's Nephilim spirits explanation makes sense to me. Why would a being made a little higher than humans desire to live within a human?
Yeah, there are several explanations for the Nephilim and the sons of God. And so, because it tells us in Genesis 6 that these sons of God came to the daughters of men and had children by them, and the children were these Nephilim. Goliath, for example, is one of the Nephilim. They were very tall, very strong. We have no evidence that there are any female Nephilim. They all seem to be masculine. They all seem to be extremely evil. And so one reason for the flood was God wanted to wipe out the Nephilim, but it tells us the sons of God came back after the flood, so the problem recurred. And it took David's mighty men to wipe out the last of the Nephilim. Heiser's idea, and by the way, there are three main theories for who these Nephilim are. One is that fallen angels were the ones that looked upon the daughters of men, and as it tells us in the text, noticed that they were beautiful, had intercourse with them, and this gave rise to the Nephilim. A second theory is that it's demon-possessed people, demon-possessed men, that wound up having these children and giving rise to the Nephilim. A third one, which is a very recent theory, only in the last century has this theory come up, is that God had commanded the sons of Seth not to marry the daughters of Cain. But some did, and when they did, they gave rise to the Nephilim. Those are the three theories. And, you know, Michael Heiser's idea is that, you know, demons were involved, but what's happening is that you have this Nephilim that's partly demonic and partly human. So, and I discuss this in the book Navigating Genesis. Basically what I do is I actually show you all the scripture passages in the Bible that talk about sons of God or children of God. Also all the scripture passages that talk about the Son of Man versus the Son of God. And just kind of point out to the, isn't it interesting, Jesus called himself the Son of Man while he was incarnated here on earth. After he rose from the dead and sent the Holy Spirit to indwell his followers, he no longer called himself the Son of Man. He was called the Son of God. But something else, Jesus referred to his followers while he was living here on earth as sons of men and children of men. But after the Holy Spirit began to indwell his followers, he only called them sons of God and children of God, which would seem to rule out the idea that human beings were basically responsible for the Nephilim. That's a strike against the idea that God had commanded the sons of Seth not to marry the daughters of Cain. By the way, people hold that view, do admit there's nothing in Scripture that would suggest that God gave a command like that to the sons of Seth. But it's something that they speculate, mainly because they think, wait a minute, Scripture also tells us that the angels do not marry. Why would you have these angels marrying the women? But people push back on that and said, well, nowhere in the text does it say they cannot marry. And something I've seen in my own ministry, working with people that are under demonic oppression or demonically possessed, it seems like these fallen angels are really obsessed with immoral sex. How do you explain the fact that they just seem to be so incredibly obsessed with sexual immorality, unless they had that capacity? That's kind of the range of the debate. But what I encourage you to do is look at all those passages that I record for you in Navigating Genesis. Make up your own mind which one you'd like to suggest. So now, Michael Heiser has passed away. I actually got to share the platform with him when we were both speaking at the University of Wisconsin. One thing I commend Michael Heiser for is he's alerting the American church that, hey, you're not paying sufficient attention to angels and demons. The Bible speaks of them. Christians in America tend to ignore all that. It says, how often do you hear a sermon on angels or demons? Very seldom. He says, we need to correct that. I personally think he overdoes it. And I think he gives way too much credit to these angels and demons. I don't think they're involved at the level he thinks. And I certainly don't think God shared any of his creation activity with the angels. He himself created. The book of Isaiah is very clear. God and God alone creates. The angels did not play any role. This council he speaks about, I don't think there's any support for that in Scripture. Now, he was an accommodationist, so I do discuss his accommodationist beliefs in my book, Rescuing Inerrancy. But hey, he passed away a couple of years ago. Okay, next question.
Do you think that tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes have anything to do with the curse of the earth?
Yes, I do believe there were hurricanes and tornadoes and wildfires and pestilence before Adam and Eve fell in the Garden of Eden. We see a lot of evidence of that in our geological studies. So, for example, we see evidence in the Adriatic Sea that long before humans lived on the face of the earth, there was a tsunami that swept up debris 1,000 feet high on the mountains and hills surrounding the Adriatic Sea. We can see that. We can date it. It dates back to 2.58 million years ago. Interesting thing about that date, it's the same date when a huge asteroid struck in the South Pacific, just off to the west side of the south tip of South America, the Altanan Impactor. And because of the size of that asteroid and the fact that it hit in 17,000 feet deep of water, it would have caused a massive tsunami. And we literally see evidence of that tsunami all around the world. Incidentally, they've actually taken a survey of the sea floor, and they can actually see evidence for that asteroid collision at 17,000 feet below the surface. So that's just one example where we see evidence that tsunamis and wildfires and tornadoes and earthquakes were occurring. And Jesus said, in this world you'll have tribulation. That's part of the tribulation, something we experience here in Southern California. We get earthquakes. We get wildfires. But something I've written about as far back as 2006 and 2009, what we notice about all these things we call natural disasters, they're all at the optimal level for human flourishing and existence. So your life would be a lot more miserable if there were no earthquakes. If you got no earthquakes, you got no mechanism to recycle the nutrients. You got no mechanism to sustain the plate tectonics. All that is crucial for us to be able to thrive here on planet Earth. And if you don't have tornadoes, then you got no thermostat to cool the hot oceans. I mean, what really causes a hurricane is you got hot tropical water, and you got this cold weather front coming in, generates a tornado, but the tornado causes a huge thick cloud barrier, drops lots of rain. What does it do? It cools off the ocean, but also has an impact on cooling hot continental areas. So life would be a lot more intolerable in Texas and Florida and Louisiana if it wasn't for tornadoes. And the same thing's true of wildfires. So for example, we notice here in Southern California, we live in a place where there are wildfires. And by the way, God could easily give us a realm where there's no wildfires at all. All you got to do is drop the oxygen level. Drop the oxygen level down, no more wildfires. But if you drop the oxygen level down, we would either be really dormant as human beings. We need a high oxygen level to be able to do all the things that we do. If you don't believe that, try climbing Mount Whitney and see what happens when you get up high enough where there isn't the oxygen you have at sea level. You'll notice you got to walk a lot slower. In fact, I can tell you a funny story. 20 African missionaries I know were in their 20s and early 30s, and they decided to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And by the way, it's not a technical climb. It's a walk all the way to the top. But it's over 20,000 feet high. And so they all went off to climb this mountain. And what happened? None of the men made it to the top. All of the women made it to the top. Why? Because the women decided we're going to walk really slowly up this mountain. The men were kind of racing to see if they could get to the top first. And they reached a point where there just wasn't enough oxygen to sustain effort at that level. None of them made it to the top. All the women did. So, yeah. Without the oxygen, and by the way, we were to raise the oxygen level up 1%, you'd discover there'd be wildfires everywhere. The oxygen level is at the ideal level. Moreover, you need wildfires to condition the soil. What happens in a wildfire, trees and grasses will burn, and they wind up depositing charcoal into the soil. That charcoal has a property of conditioning the soil and being able to absorb a huge quantity of water. And we notice here in Southern California, it doesn't rain very often. But because of all the charcoal in the soil, that rainwater actually gets set in the soil, and it can last for many, many months. Which means even if you have a six-month-long period where there's no rain, you can still have vegetation growing. And so what I wrote in More Than a Theory, everything we call a natural disaster is at the optimal level and number and intensity to make life as pleasant as possible, given the laws of physics. But hey, in the new creation, because of different laws of physics, no more hurricanes, no more tornadoes, no more earthquakes. And incidentally, it was Jesus who said, build your house on a rock, don't build it on the sand. Recognizing that these things will happen, prepare for them. Here's a good example. New Zealand had the same intense earthquake that Haiti had in the same year. Okay, the consequence of that magnitude 7 plus earthquake in New Zealand was two people died and there was a few million dollars of damage. What happened in Haiti? 150,000 people died. Huge damage. The country is still trying to recover from that to this very day. The difference, in New Zealand, they prepared for earthquakes. In Haiti, they did not. And so, again, build your house on a rock. And you may be complaining about how expensive homes are here in California compared to homes, say, in Nebraska or South Dakota. It's because we have to put twice as much lumber into our homes as you do. And there are other reasons why our home prices are so high, but that's one reason. Our homes are built to withstand earthquakes at a certain level. So again, build your house on the rock. Next question.
Okay. Craig McMahon, your book, Designed to the Core, provided reasons for the components of the observable universe. Any speculation what the non-observable universe is for?
What's the non-observable universe for? Well, when I was a teenager, the extent of the universe that we could observe was 1/1000th of a percent of what we can observe today. So until very recently, we couldn't really see much of the potentially observable universe. Today we can, thanks to our technology. There's still parts we haven't explored because of how far away they are. But one thing we know is that the total mass of the universe has to be exactly what it is in order for us to have this paradoxes class today, in order for us to even to exist. Even for a bacterium to exist, the mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned. And it must be fine-tuned to a degree that's far, far greater than the best fine-tuning in any human instrument that's ever been invented and constructed. And the reason for that is the mass of the universe determines what elements you get in the periodic table. Make the universe slightly less massive than it is, then the only elements that can possibly exist in the universe will be hydrogen or hydrogen and helium and nothing else. Make the universe the tiniest bit more massive, during the first 4 minutes after the creation event, more than 25% of the hydrogen will be fused into helium, which means the future stars will have a higher quantity of helium in them than stars do today. That higher quantity of helium will cause those stars to fuse the hydrogen and helium into elements as heavy as iron or heavier. In both cases, you wind up with a universe with no carbon, no oxygen, no nitrogen, and no possibility of life. And so the total mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned to get the periodic table. And moreover, the size of the universe has to be fine-tuned for life to be possible here on planet Earth. So hey, if God wanted life on just one planet, the universe has to be exactly the size that it is, the age that it is, and the mass that it is. All that has to be fine-tuned.
You mentioned earlier that the Arabic nations created algebra. I kind of relate to mathematics as principles that have existed a long time, and we discovered these principles. And I got a long discussion with Alexa this morning, and I was making a claim, because it doesn't matter if I'm polite to Alexa or not, but I was making a claim that mathematics pre-existed at Big Bang, and I was wondering if you would agree with that, that mathematics could be considered both a physical thing and a metaphysical thing. The Trinity has three persons, so there's mathematical principles there. And then also I wanted to ask you if you could comment on Mandelbrot numbers, fractal numbers.
Okay. let me try to take that.
Is that too much?
Okay. What was the first thing you're asking about was?
The first one was about mathematics, if it...
Yes, mathematics.
Yeah, if it pre-existed creation.
Well, mathematics is not a substance, but because God designed the universe with laws of physics that are immutable, that means we can use math to predict the behavior of the physics. So mathematics is descriptive. It's a tool that enables us to explain what's going on in reality. So it's one reason why you see mathematics flourishing in a Christian worldview, because mathematics is based on the idea, hey, the natural realm is immutable in terms of its physics, which means we can actually develop mathematical constructs to predict its behavior. So now, yes, it was Muslims in the 9th century that came up with algebra. And it's because they were seriously studying the Old New Testament. Interesting thing about Islam in the 19th century is they valued the study of the Old New Testament. And studying that's really what caused them. And that ninth century is also a time when the economy of Christian Europe was not doing that well, whereas the economy of the Islamic world was doing well. And science flourishes when you can grow enough food that you can set aside people who don't have to be involved in agriculture and providing food for the family. I mean, one reason for the technological advances we see here in the United States, less than 1% of our population is devoted to procuring food. And even with only 1%, we grow so much food, we can export it to the rest of the world. But that also means more than 99% of us can do music, art, mathematics, engineering, and science, and all other kinds of activities. And if you can set millions of people free to do mathematics and science, things will happen. So, again, that was also a product of the Reformation. In Reformation Europe, people were reading the Bible, and what did they discover? The work ethic. As they began to practice that work ethic and also recognize we're to enjoy the work that we do, that allowed Europe to be able to set free people to focus on science. So you've got people like Roger Bacon, very early in the 1200s and 1300s, being able to devote his time fully to science, and that's really helped flourish the scientific revolution. So did math predate the universe? Math basically is a tool to describe the operation of the universe. Is there a different math for the angelic realm? Probably. And notice, math continues to advance in step with our scientific technology. And so I've lived long enough to recognize there have been mathematical tools invented at multiple times in my life to take on problems in science that nobody even knew were problems to start with. But that, again, is evidence. Math is a descriptive tool. It's not a physical entity. It's a descriptive tool.
Richard House, how should we understand Hebrews 2:14, since it seems that Satan is still doing things today?
Okay, Hebrews 2:14?
Yes.
Hey, can you use your smartphone to read Hebrews 2:14 or someone else here? I mean, that's the interesting thing about being alive in the 21st century. I remember 50, 60 years ago, the pastor would say, get out your Bible and go to Mark 3:14. Now the pastor says, get out your smartphone and look up Mark 3:14. Nobody brings Bibles to churches anymore because it's all built into your phone. But I like someone to read that passage.
I don't want to change my setting right now.
Oh, no. Well, we got someone to... So Lily's going to read it for us. Go for it.
You want to read it?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead and read it.
I'm waiting to ask.
Okay.
Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil.
Okay, good. Yeah, I would broaden the context to include all of Hebrews 1 and Hebrews 2, because you see in Hebrews 1, the author of the book of Hebrews is dealing with something to a far greater degree than we were talking about with Michael Heiser. What's happening in the first century is that people were giving way too much credit and attention to the angels and basically claiming that Jesus was an angel. And so the author of the book of Hebrews is making the point that Jesus is God and he's way beyond the angels. In fact, what's interesting about the book of Hebrews, it actually makes the point that the righteous angels are ministering spirits to assist human Christians in their ministry. So he's basically saying, don't demean yourself. You have a very high role in God's creation, a role that angels cannot fulfill. Now, they have a role we can't fulfill, but we have a role they can't fulfill. But he's also making the point there's a vast chasm between Jesus and the righteous angels. So now, what we see in Hebrews 2, it says, notice Jesus came in physical form and lived amongst us for probably 34 or so years. Angels do appear to us in physical form. There's cases, for example, where a couple of angels actually had dinner with Abraham. They had dinner with Lot, but it's a brief. And what they're saying about Jesus, he came in physical form. He lived just like you lived. He suffered just like you did. And for that reason, he was able to atone in the way the angels can't. So he's making the point, there's only one Redeemer. The angels do not participate in redemption. They don't participate in creation. But God created them to fulfill a particular role. And he's making the point, we're not to worship the angels. We're not to worship humans. We're only to worship the Creator. God himself is the only one that's worthy of worship. So that's the main point, but I'd argue this. Actually read all the way through to chapter 13. So 13 of the first chapters of the book of Hebrews, every one of them is dealing with a relationship between God and the angels. It actually deals with some of the difficult passages. Why in the Old Testament is Jesus called the angel of the Lord? What's going on there? Why does he take on the title Melchizedek? What's going on there? So he's basically getting to the heart of the speculations that were going on with Jewish theologians who were attributing way more credit and power to the angels than what the Bible actually attributes. So that's the main goal that we see. And also a main point of Hebrews is realize that, hey, right now we're lower than the angels, but God has a special role for us. Making the point, we are the participants of God's grace. We are the receivers of God's grace. The angels have to observe God's grace, which is why a time will come when we will be teaching and instructing the angels, because we've gone through the graduate course. They have not. They just simply watch us gaining knowledge and understanding from experiencing the grace of God. They simply have to be content to observe it. Yes.
So I have a question about bad, evil, versus good and righteous. And I know you've said many times before that the population would be so much larger had we not had so many murders so long ago. And then you just now, today, were saying, I think that the only righteous family was one that was left. So what is it that intrigues evil so much to go after and kill righteous?
Yeah, what's interesting, when you look at the beginning of Genesis chapter 6, it describes the evil of of Noah's compatriots. It uses two words, Shakak and Hamas, to describe the evil of those people. And those words are never put together, the two of them, to describe any other generation of humanity. And those words basically make the point. The compatriots of Noah and his family were so degraded and evil that all they could think was evil thoughts all the time. All they could think about, how can I harm and oppress my fellow human beings? And it's making the point, they were obsessed with doing physical harm upon their fellow human beings and also their animals. And so, I mean, that's one thing that they tell you today is that, a lot of serial killers, you notice they begin by really torturing and killing animals. Then they move on to human beings. But these are individuals who are so reprobate. Every thought they think is an evil thought. Every action they perform is one of doing damage to their fellow human beings. And so the murder rate ran out of control. In fact, to explain why we have no human remains and no human artifacts from the pre-flood era, the human population had to be so low that at least 90% of living humans had their lives terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. I mean, the incredible thing is, even though they had the potential to live 969 years, the average lifespan today is probably greater than the average lifespan that was the case during Noah's generation. Very few people were actually dying a normal death. In fact, I've often wondered, maybe the genealogy in Genesis 5 is describing those few patriarchs that didn't get murdered by their fellow man. Maybe the murder rate could have been as high as 99%. Had to be at least 90%, but it could have been as high as 99%. And again, with a murder rate that high, who's going to be preferentially killed off? Well, the people that are virtuous and righteous, they're the ones that are going to be the targets of people who are intent on murder.
Okay. There's a question from Tenny. Hi, Dr. Ross. Who and which institutions advanced the study of the Old Testament and New Testament among Muslims for the creation of algebra? I grew up in Oman. When I was a kid, I was so fascinated with Arabia.
Yeah. Well, again, part of it was that the Christian world was in an economically depressed state, whereas the Islamic world was doing quite well. And this enabled people to be set free to do other things. I mean, that's also a time when music flourished in the Islamic world. So that's part of the factor there. And also as a time when Muslims were encouraged to treat the people of the book well. So it meant that was a time when they were actually engaging Jews and Christians. And by the way, there are still sects of Islam today that do that. In fact, I got to meet a medical doctor who escaped from India. And he came here because he and his family were the leaders of an Islamic sect where they said, we reject the doctrine of abrogation. We believe that all of the Quran needs to be treated as faithful and true, and that later passages in the Quran do not negate the earlier passages. And for that reason, he felt that it was crucial that as a Muslim, he treats Christians and Jews with respect, and also that he gives serious study to the Old and the New Testament. But that's rare amongst the Islamic population in the world today. Typically, their whole focus is on the Quran, and also they believe in the doctrine of abrogation. And the challenge of that is the later passages in the Quran basically say that they're to persecute and even kill people who are not Muslims. So again, very different than what you see earlier in the Quran. But so I was talking to this medical doctor, he was saying the real goal of his Islamic sect is to bring unity amongst Christians, Jews, and Muslims. We said we have a lot in common. The Old and New Testament is in common. I got to talk to him for a couple of hours, basically making the point, yes, but there's still a major difference between the Old and New Testament and the Quran, even if you don't accept the doctrine of abrogation. And he was listening, so I still pray for him. But it is interesting, there are a few small sects today in Islam where they give serious study to the Old and New Testament. And those would be the texts that would really tell you mathematics is a discipline that's worth spending some time in. And what I find interesting about mathematics, of all the scientific disciplines, that's where you see by far the highest belief in God and an afterlife. It's over 80%. Next question.
I guess this is sort of a non sequitur.
You're okay. I love non sequiturs. Okay. Go for it.
And it's a personal question, plus I wanted to address something else. I've been trying to make a change in my life, and I'm wondering, I'm trying to sleep more. How many hours a night do you sleep?
Well, I have medical issues that make it challenging for me to sleep 8 hours. So I have to get up several times to head to the restroom.
Yeah.
So So my sleep gets interrupted, but I sleep between 7 and 8 hours.
That's good.
But that's including a nap I take in the afternoon.
Okay, because so, I set up a reward system.
Before I had my medical issues, I could sleep 8 hours, no problem. And I make it a point just to relax. I mean, one of the things I've noticed, people like me that are on the autistic spectrum, it's very easy for them to live a disciplined life. I mean, my wife gets upset at me because I don't care about the flavor of food. I just eat what I know is healthy for me. And I said, hey, if you do it, you eventually like the stuff that you think you don't like. Just get used to it. It works. I noticed, for example, almost everybody on the autistic spectrum are teetotalers. It's not because they don't like alcohol. They say, hey, it's not good for your health, therefore forget it. They just don't bother with it. So, but it's also true, it helps me in my exercise, it helps me in my sleep patterns, but I'm not sleeping as well as I did before I had these medical issues.
So, and you were talking about brain function earlier and chromosomes length and all that. Isn't sleep supposed to be very good for your mind?
Yes, your brain needs to have sleep to be in top tip shape. It's important that you do that. And therefore, I try to make it a point when I got a lot of stress in my life to go through some exercises before I go to sleep, just realizing if I'm in a stressful state or if my heart rate is up, I'm not going to be able to get a good night's sleep. I got to find some way to transition from that high stress. Sometimes that happens to me in the road where they got me speaking all day and engaging people all day, then going back to the hotel, and you're still kind of on a high from all of what's going on. But just trying to say, how can I practice a transition? So things like, you know, don't eat a heavy meal. Sometimes that happens to me. I'm on the road and I'm speaking all day. At the very end of the day, I get fed. So now I'm back at the hotel. I got a heavy stomach, and I'm supposed to go to sleep. It doesn't work well. So just little things like that, knowing that.
A ton of self-discipline to get this, to accomplish my goal. It's crazy. It's, you know, I've quit other things, but to start a new habit like this is just...
Well, incidentally, you bring up a good point. What disrupts sleep is light. And what we're noticing worldwide, there's an increasing sleep problem amongst the human species. You want to know why? LED lighting.
Yeah.
LED lighting has made nighttime illumination 3 to 4 times what it was before LED lighting became cheap. In fact, I've put things on my Facebook page showing you what London looks like today compared to what London looked like 20 years ago. The nighttime illumination is about a factor of 10 brighter. Wow. It's that big of an effect. Here in the Los Angeles basin, we've also seen a huge uptake in illumination. It's such that they no longer use the Mount Wilson telescope for serious astronomical observations. There's just too much light coming from the environment here. And by the way, it doesn't just affect humans. They've noticed, for example, that beach resorts, the LED lighting is killing the coral reefs. Those coral reefs need it dark at night. And so there's now an attempt to say, you know what, these beach resorts, turn off your lights at night. So, but now they actually have scuba divers going around with LED lighting at night. And so they're thinking, maybe we need to ban people doing that kind of scuba diving at night. But good point.
We have a couple more, one more online question and one in-house. So we're running out of time, though.
I'll try to be quick. Go ahead.
Dr. Ross, just a couple of nights ago, I watched the Christiana Amanpour program, and one of her staff, Isaacson, who wrote an autobiography of...
Yeah, I'm
having
a hard
John.
Time hearing you. What was it that you watched?
Okay, the question, the Isaacson, a staff of the Christiana Amanpour program, interviewed this author. The name is Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-A-N. And the question was, the subject was kind of machines. and something to do with, I think, AI. And what stirs my imagination is the question to the author is, someday, or is there a possibility that you can give senses to a machine? In other words, a sense of, the word is disgusting. If the machine gets disgusted, he will react to the people who are using him. And to my mind, I think he can also inject a sense of hunger on these machines. So, could you comment on the possibility that human beings can inject sensibilities on this machine, and the consequence, I mean, to my thinking is that if this machine would have some sense of feeling and they get disgusted at human beings, there's gonna be a fight between machine and humans, and you can think of all the extreme possibilities that, you know, if they get disgusted, they get mad at men, they're gonna, you know, choke us or strangle us, and how would we human beings react? We have to shoot them to stop them from hitting us. And therefore, would there be a criminal act that would be charged against the human beings because he killed a machine? You know, and also, well, the bottom line is, I would give you enough time to read that book by Michael Pollan. I don't know, I forgot the title, but I just remember the name of the author, Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-A-N.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the debate. The debate is over whether AI will ever become sentient. It's basically a debate. Is AI always going to be weak or will it become strong? Weak AI basically tells us that artificial intelligence will never advance to the point where it can produce brand new databases, where it can actually think and reason. And that debate is pretty much settled in the sense that we now recognize that AI systems are 100% dependent on the data that's fed into them. They can analyze these databases in a way that humans have never analyzed them before, which might make it look like they've produced a new database. But with the new database they produce, it's completely dependent on the databases it already has. And these AI systems are not able to reason. They can copy our reasoning patterns. To give you an example, there's an AI system called Minerva. It's 3 times bigger than ChatGPT. It's also specialized. All it does is mathematics, nothing else. And so they fed into it just millions of pages of mathematical papers and books and examples of math problems being solved. But as sophisticated and as advanced as this AI system is, when it was challenged to do a competition with a grade 9 algebra student, the grade 9 algebra student was able to score 98%, Minerva scored 50%. The reason why is that the 14-year-old boy was able to reason, and therefore, given a new algebra problem it hadn't seen before, he could reason through it and develop a solution. Meanwhile, Minerva was going through its vast database to see if it could find an algebra problem that was really similar to the one it was looking at. And if it's really similar or identical, it can get the right answer. But if it's not in its database, it doesn't do well at all. It just makes a guess, and usually the guess is incorrect. So this is evidence. It can't reason, but it can analyze at incredible speeds. So, and it's also energy intensive. So for example, Minerva required the electricity sufficient to sustain 1,000 small cities to be able to perform that algebra test. The 14-year-old boy only needed a small hamburger to be able to do it. So the energy demands are huge. And AI is going to be able to do a lot more than it's doing right now, but it is causing an energy crisis because the energy it needs is just enormous. And now we've got to find some way to feed the energy into these AI systems that won't increase the heat burden of the planet. So looking for ways of trying to feed electricity into these AI systems that doesn't pump more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Because the way AI is going, it's going to bring on global warming a lot faster than we think. So, and we've got to find the electricity somewhere. So cryptocurrency and AI are really draining our electricity reserves at an alarming rate. But hey, can't you love a system where I can feed into it a 400-page technical book, and within 15 seconds, it produces a comic book, it produces a video, it produces a film, and it produces a little short story to go with it. No human can work at that speed. AI can. And so I'm personally using AI. It's amazing what it can do in just a few seconds. I mean, I basically fed it a really technical paper that I just wrote and said, turn this in to a podcast, a video podcast that lay people can understand. You know how long it took to produce it? 14 seconds. And the video was incredible, really beautiful, full color, had two people talking to one another. And if I wanted to, I could say, make an avatar for the two. I said, I don't need an avatar. I'll just have the two of them talk. They don't have to show up as persons. But AI could actually make them show up as persons. Now, you're making the point. Can you actually program AI that it can emotionally engage us? The answer is yes. AI is already doing that. So, for example, they have AI therapists where you can talk to them and deal with your marriage problems or the problems you're having with your children or people at work. And it's programmed to speak to you in a very empathetic voice. So it picks up on your cues, is actually able to analyze the tone of your voice and determine what kind of emotion you're expressing and respond back with an emotion. And it's so good that most people prefer to see an AI therapist as opposed to a human therapist, because a human therapist isn't going to be that sensitive to your emotions and maybe get angry at you, whereas you can program the AI therapist. No matter what the human says, don't get angry, don't get upset, don't get disturbed, don't get frustrated, whereas that's not going to happen with a human being. However, right now, Congress is considering a law basically saying all AI therapists have to identify themselves as machines and not human beings. Because the AI system is so good, people think they're talking to a real human being. But hey, if you ever go to an AI therapist, notice that the therapy is very Rogerian. It doesn't tell you what to do or how to change your life. It asks you questions so that you can figure it out for yourself. And AI systems are really good at asking you questions. They don't have to know anything. They just know how to ask the right question. So if you want to see a good Rogerian therapist, AI is probably the best that there is. But you know, having someone just ask you questions and never give you any advice, maybe that's not the best therapist to see. And one reason why Congress is considering this law, there's a man that divorced his wife in order to marry his AI therapist. He thought it was a human being. So that's why they're saying, hey, there are real consequences here. We have to deal with it. And incidentally, we have a policy at Reasons to Believe. Whenever we use AI, we tell you that we've used it, and we tell you where we used it and where we did not use it.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Dr. Ross. Been very enlightening. And would you close us in prayer now, please?
Happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. Thank you, Lord, for setting up the Sabbath where we get to spend regular time to focus on the most important issues of life. Father, I pray that we would think about the things we've been discussing this day and look at how we can share this with other people, change the way we live in a more way that honors you, and help us also to be grateful Lord, this planet you've given us is just so amazing in the way it provides for our needs. You didn't have to make this planet as beautiful as you did. You didn't have to make it so nutrient-rich. Thank you, Lord, for the care you've demonstrated to us in everything that you've created. So, Father, I pray as we leave this time, help us to maintain a grateful spirit to you and to all the people we engage. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.